Radiotopia.
Welcome to the Kitchen Sisters present.
From PRX.
We're the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson
and Nikki Silva.
Hi, I'm excited to tell you that one of our favorite Radiotopia siblings, Ear Hustle, is back with a new season. Ear Hustle is a show about life in prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast. Co-hosts Nigel Poor and Erlon Woods have recently been spending time at four California prisons and have a season's worth of funny, surprising, and unforgettable stories to share. In a recent episode, they were able to visit a groundbreaking prison hospice where they spoke to men who are grappling with the reality of dying inside prison. Also coming up this season are stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells, complicated mom-daughter relationships in prison, and incarcerated people who wonder whether they've become too comfortable behind bars. Stories about life on the inside told by those who live it. Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts. The Kitchen Sisters Present is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
All right, we're going to roll. Ready?
I always start with this image of Earthrise made on Christmas Eve, December 24th, 1968, on the first mission to go all the way out to the moon. One of the astronauts saw out of the corner of his eye this amazing image. They didn't expect it.
Oh my God, look at that picture over there. There's the Earth coming up. Wow.
Sounds like a family on vacation in a station wagon.
Give me a roll of color quick.
Oh man,
that's great.
Quick, where's my camera? Get me some color film.
Several up here. Wait a minute, let's get the right setting here. Calm down, Mama. Oh, I got it right. Oh, that's a beautiful shot.
This one's called the Blue Marble, and it was from Apollo 17, the last image taken by a human being from far enough out in space to see the planet whole, the most published photograph in all of history. I do so many slideshows and presentations, I just never get nervous anymore, but I'm nervous before this one, the very first climate underground conference here on Gore Farm.
Al Gore is back, and he's got a new slideshow. Better take heed. Last October, the former vice president, Nobel Prize winner, and Academy Award winner for An Inconvenient Truth, and activist, restaurateur, founder of the Edible Schoolyard, Alice Waters, gathered farmers, ranchers, scientists, chefs, researchers, and policymakers on Al's family farm in Carthage, Tennessee, for a riveting set of conversations about the role of food and regenerative agriculture in solving the climate crisis. They called the two-day event the Climate Underground. Along with the conversations, some of Nashville's hottest chefs joined Alice in creating a sustainable organic school lunch to highlight the power of local, school-supported agriculture in nurturing the health of children and the land. This event happened long before the moment we all find ourselves in right now, as the coronavirus pandemic sweeps across the planet. But it holds seeds and hope for a different approach to our future and the fate of the planet we all share. In honor of Earth Day, the Kitchen Sisters present the Climate Underground.
As a child, from the first year of my life all the way through until I was in college, I spent every summer here on this farm, and every Christmas and every spring vacation. And my father taught me how to recognize the best and most fertile soil. Put my hands in it and it was black and moist. I always believed agriculture and the food system are absolutely key to solving and mitigating the climate crisis. We have converted this farm to a whole variety of regenerative practices, a combination of plants and livestock with highly diverse cover crops and maximum use of no-till, avoiding synthetic insecticide. We harvested our first crop according to these new practices in 2016, only 3 years ago. So I'm very excited that we have not only regenerative farmers, but also scientists and entrepreneurs and chefs. We've got some really great chefs here.
We're at Al Gore's farm in Carthage, Tennessee. We are cooking two school lunches for 350 people who are attending Climate Underground, a conference about connecting food and farming to climate. I'm Alice Waters, the owner of Chez Panisse Restaurant in Berkeley, California, and the founder of the Edible Schoolyard Project, which has grown from one school in Berkeley to a network of 7,000 schools around the world.
We're here today to acknowledge the land, not just here in this area, but all over Turtle Island and the Americas. My name is Mary Crow. I am a member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee. You are here today because you have a concern. You have a major concern about the soil, about the air, about the water.
I'm really happy to introduce my partner in putting together this event, Alice Waters, who is providing all of the delicious and nutritious food. In addition to her groundbreaking work as a chef and a pioneer in the movement for organic and local food, Alice is also a committed advocate for the role that food and agriculture can play in protecting our environment. How'd you get started with the Edible School Project?
It really began when I had a child. I was a Montessori teacher. The ideas of Montessori have informed all of my work. She believed in the education of the senses. She believed in touching and tasting and smelling. When I started the Edible Schoolyard Project, I said, food is a way to really open up the senses because it touches every one of them. If we put in a garden and we put in a kitchen classroom, we could wake up the young people who have been sensorily deprived, many of them because of hunger and because of poverty, because of an indoctrination of fast food culture.
Throughout most of human history, the daily ritual and practice of collecting, gathering, preparing, eating food together has been a key part of the connection between individuals and nature. And in order to reestablish that connection for children, you look for other opportunities, and you found one in the school system.
I mean, it's the place where we can reach children when they're young and open. The idea of this is to have them fall in love with nature. Food is more than just food. Food is really about culture. We have been indoctrinated by a fast food culture. When we eat that, we digest the values that come with it. The ideas of uniformity, the ideas that we should have whatever we want whenever we want it. Doesn't matter where it comes from. Cooking is drudgery. Farming is drudgery. We think advertising confers value. The centerpiece of this project is a civilized, sustainable school lunch.
And before you focused on the school system and the Edible Schoolyard Project, your career as a chef was really transformative. What got you involved with that?
It was all about taste for me. Taste and beauty. I had gone to France when I was 19, and it was a slow food nation in France then. Kids came home for 2 hours to eat with their parents, And every day, people would go to the markets in their neighborhoods, beautiful outdoor markets, and you bought only what was in season. We would go and eat in these little family restaurants that are happening again. People see that making a restaurant can be a way of life, that they can have a real connection with the people that come in. And I love that about the restaurants I visited here in Nashville. And I feel such a kinship with that group of people already because we have the same values. That's what's important about this and what we need to communicate to the next generation. It's something that we've been doing since the beginning of civilization, gathering together, eating only what's in season, only what's locally available. Even though fast food culture would say it's impossible to feed kids in schools. There are too many. They don't like it. You can't find the food. But guess what? We can.
Chapter 1. A Fable for Tomorrow. There was once a town in the heart of America where all life seemed to live in harmony with its surroundings. The town lay in the midst of a checkerboard of prosperous farms, with fields of grain and hillsides of orchards, where in the spring, white clouds of bloom drifted above the green fields. In autumn, oak and maple and birch set up a blaze of color that flamed and flickered across a backdrop of pines. Then foxes barked in the hills and deer silently crossed the fields, half hidden.
It was on this farm that my mother insisted that my sister and I listen to her read aloud from Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. My dad's generation was really focused on soil conservation. Franklin Roosevelt made that a key part of the New Deal. My parents' generation understood that in their bones. They lived through it.
I shall never forget the fields of wheat, so blasted by heat that they cannot be harvested. I shall never forget field after field of corn, stunted, earless, stripped of leaves. For what the sun left, the grasshoppers took. I saw brown pasture that would not keep a cow on 50 acres. Yet I would not have you think for a single minute that there is permanent disaster in these drought regions. No cracked earth, no blistering sun, no burning wind, no grasshoppers are a permanent match for the indomitable American farmers and stockmen and their wives and children who have carried on through...
In the last 200 years, we've taken this leap in destroying the grasslands of the world. All of the agricultural systems of the last 100 years have seen this massive decimation of soil and biological life in this microbiome that has disappeared under the pressure of the antibiotics put into our animals and crops. I'm Dr. Zach Bush. I am a medical doctor from Virginia, specialties in internal medicine and endocrinology and metabolism, leader in hospice and palliative care. And my background is in the microbiome and its intersection with soil and human health. We're really talking about a new paradigm for the topic of climate change, where we can start to focus less on the symptoms of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and start to look towards the solutions, which are in the soil.
About 28% of all the global warming pollution comes from land use, agriculture, and forestry. But here's good news. With the practice of no-till versus conventional till, after 10 years, you can see the buildup of soil organic carbon.
We have 40 years worth of data that showcases that the way we farm has a huge impact on how much carbon we can sequester.
When native ecosystems, forests, and native prairies are converted to intensive agricultural practices, within about 30 or so years, you can lose up to 50% of the carbon in topsoil. So what that says to me is, at the very least, we have a potential to restore that much. Restoring this carbon is obviously very important from a climate perspective, but it comes with multiple other co-benefits that are essential for human and other beings.
Soils is part of the portfolio of strategies that we could deploy to address climate change. But soils aren't going to solve the problem alone. It's frustrating even as a scientist in the scientific community when you talk about carbon sequestration or climate change mitigation with agricultural practices, to have colleagues get angry at me and say, it's all about fossil fuels. And it is all about fossil fuels. We have to reduce emissions. There's just no way. You know, we've got to fix our energy systems. We've got to change our lifestyles. And in addition, we need to develop ways in which we can remove CO2 out of the atmosphere. And soils are a great place to do that.
Can it solve all the problems? Maybe not. But is it a good place to start with? Absolutely.
The carbon sequestration in soil is a natural process. It's a low-hanging fruit. It's cost-effective. It has many benefits. Start with that. Don't ignore it.
Yeah.
To feed the world, we have to have healthy soil.
We'll be right back. The Kitchen Sisters Present is sponsored by Sakara, a nutrition company that believes wellness begins with what you eat. You can stay home, stay healthy, and strengthen your immunity with fresh, delicious meals delivered straight to your door from Sakara. They've got hearty salads and nutrient-dense granolas, savory flatbreads, and seasonal fruit parfaits, all 100% plant-based, gluten-free, dairy-free, and non-GMO. In addition to their delicious meals, Sakara also offers daily essentials like supplements and herbal teas to complete your wellness routine and support overall health and vitality. To boost immunity, try their best-selling daily probiotic blend or detox water drops with pure chlorophyll. And right now, Sakara is offering our listeners 20% off their order when they go to sakara.com/kitchensisters or enter code kitchensisters at checkout. That's Sakara, sakara.com/kitchensisters to get 20% off your order. sakara.com/kitchensisters.
I'm looking at the tables that we have set in long lines under a tent. All the food that we have for this lunch has been gathered from regenerative farms across the state of Tennessee. So we have a placemat with the state of Tennessee, pinpointing all of these farms. When people come to eat, I'm going to say, I'd like to feed you an idea.
I'd like to feed you an idea. We're serving you a school lunch.
Woo!
We're serving you a vegetarian school lunch.
Yeah.
A real Tennessee meal. If you look on your placemat, you'll see all of the farms here in Tennessee where we purchase the food. All of it from people that are really activists here in Tennessee. I never knew you had so many. Bon appetit.
I was dancing with my darling to the Tennessee waltz when an old friend I happened to see.
Dee Wagner, Alice's On the Road team. The cornmeal, the flour, the vinegar. This particular menu, both days are sourced within 70 miles of here. And we really dug into what Tennessee could provide.
We are about to feed 350 people a fair amount of food that we got from around here. A lot of our farmers pitched in. Everything is simple, trying to let the ingredients shine.
I'm Davis Reese from Haas Nashville.
I'm Tandy Wilson from City House of Nashville.
I'm Sam Jett from Audrey and Redbird. In all honesty, the farmers did all the work, so all we're doing is just finishing her up and putting it on a plate and hoping people enjoy it.
Yeah. Just try not to screw up a really good product.
Yeah,
I feel like that's my job most of the time, is just don't screw up what they've already put all their work into.
Yeah.
We only have to handle it for a little bit. They have to grow it on their farm. It takes them a lot longer to do the work than it does us. The cool part too is like some of my farmers get really excited and they're like, I'm growing this weird thing. Like, do you want it? We're like, of course we want it. You're excited about it. And like,
right.
Why wouldn't we be excited about it?
They don't know on our end that unique ingredient gets us going.
Gets us going.
And the idea of having a little bit of an edge in the market to say, we have this delicious thing that nobody else has.
Exactly. Yeah, you've never heard of this, and that's because only one farmer has it, and we know them.
Yeah.
I enjoy that.
Yeah.
Why school lunch? What's your thought on why all this effort to demo a school lunch?
The idea is we've got to start early, because if you show them, you know, Chick-fil-A, Burger King, and all these things, and say, well, this is what food is, they're going to come here, and they're going to look at lettuce and go, why would I want that? That's just what goes on top of a hamburger. I mean, we had kids out here the other day, and they were, I want a quarter pounder. They're like, I don't want this. And then we brought them the food, we put it in front of them, and the girl who was complaining started eating the salad, and she looked up at me, and she smiled, and then she asked me what a pawpaw was. She loved it. I think we start that later on in life. She's going to be looking to have food like that, as opposed to stuff that you can buy quickly from a fast food restaurant.
My name is Matthew Rayford. I am a chef and farmer, or chef farmer, at Gilliard Farms in Brunswick, Georgia.
What made you decide to come here?
I called Alice. It's me, Alice. It's Matthew. And she goes, I'm so glad you called me today. She said, I'm getting ready to go do this conference, and I need you to help me with these greens and beans. And then she goes, you know what? I'm trying to find some garbanzo beans. I said, for what? She said, well, I really want to make hummus. And I was like, why don't you use field peas? Field peas are coming out right now. And she was like, oh my God, that's what we're talking about, field peas. That's right. I'm in your neck of the woods. And then she goes, wait a second. You need to be at this conference because you have a 100-year-old farm. You've been doing this kind of stuff. Your family's been doing it. And I want you to communicate and talk to people about what it's like to be in the South as a chef and a farmer, African-American. Talking about regenerative agriculture, sustainability. Yeah, these are old ways. These are the things that's going on.
I have believed for many years that farmers are the first environmentalists. The group I'm about to bring up here on stage embodies the belief that farmers can lead the way toward caring for our environment. Being good stewards of the land and the water and the air, and they are at the forefront of the emerging changes.
I farm about 675 acres, and I'm best known for running a flirt, the cattle and sheep together, and then I've added hogs, and we're converting some land to civil pasture.
We need the soil to build the quality of the food, and you need to understand those feedbacks between roots and shoots that we really spend a lot of time investing in that.
I have a small organic farm in southwestern Virginia. It's an old tobacco farm. When we bought it, it had 1.9% organic matters. It's a brick when it's dry and it's mud when it's wet. First year we had an organic inspector out. She literally could not find an earthworm on the farm, literally. So that's kind of fairly typical.
And our job is not to produce tons and tons of stuff. It is not to try to kill weeds with pesticides. Our job as farmers is to produce healthy people. And we need to begin looking at the soil as the foundation for that building block in health.
The important question to me is, how do we get back to those practices that we know can restore carbon in soil? Like restoring native vegetation whenever possible, conservation tillage practices, or practices that are able to introduce more carbon to soil, including recycling. All of these variables help us to accomplish that goal. And the added benefit of addressing this degradation issue is then we also have these co-benefits that are essential for human and other beings living on land.
One of the most profound things that I've found in recent years was the definition of nature is animals, plants, minerals, and anything non-human on Earth. What did we do when we defined nature as everything outside of human? How did we exclude ourselves from nature in its definition? What a mistake we made. My mission now, I think, is to put humanity back into the definition of nature, or perhaps put nature back into the definition of human. As a hospice director, seeing 80 patients a week, what I was seeing in the last few minutes, and sometimes days and months, of people's lives was a complete transformation event. People were acting differently than they ever had. People who were gruff and, you know, non-nurturing to their children suddenly became these like bundles of just nurture and love. As soon as you get that terminal diagnosis, there's an opportunity. There's an opportunity for you to drop the fluff, reorganize your perceived priorities, and ask yourself what really matters.
So, the Paris Agreement, a lot of hope here, set a goal to get to net zero by mid-century, and some countries are doing well. Our president announced that he wants to pull out of the Paris Agreement, but under the law, the first day the U.S. could withdraw is the day after the next presidential election. So, this agreement was carefully drafted, so the American people still have that decision. Meanwhile, we're seeing the majority of our people living in states that are accelerating faster than required by the Paris Agreement. And I don't know whether you've noticed or not, but the marchers and demonstrators are getting younger. And we're seeing with Greta Thunberg the voice of a generation that is so pure and so powerful. And now there are a whole variety of new people power options that are opening up. So this is our home. We've got to save it. I'll just close by referencing one of my favorite poets, Wallace Stevens. He wrote these lines. After the final no, there comes a yes. And on that yes, the future world depends. Every great morally based revolution in human history has met with an endless series of no's until at long last the central choice is revealed as a choice between what's right and what's wrong. That is the moment the climate movement is at now. And the farmer-led regenerative agriculture movement is part and parcel of this morally based revolution. If you ever doubt that we as human beings have the ability to solve this, just remember that political will is itself a renewable resource. Thank you very much.
The Climate Underground was produced by the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, with Matt Hoisch, in collaboration with Nathan Dalton and Brandy Howell, and mixed by Jim McKee. Thanks to the teams of Al Gore and Alice Waters, who together brought this summit to life. Thanks also to the many scientists, farmers, and visionary thinkers who put their heads together to share their collective wisdom. Thanks also to that remarkable scrum of Nashville chefs and to chef farmer Matthew Rayford from Georgia.
I've always been on the top of a stove. I am the youngest male in my extended family. What do you do with a little boy? You sit him in there in the kitchen with his grandma and cleaning field peas and snapping snap beans. And, oh, your granddaddy brought in some fish. Let's scale these fish up. I'm on family land. I'm the sixth generation to be on it farming. I was raised by a father that was a baker by trade from the 50s and 60s. During his lifetime, he never saw anyone that was African American make it to become an executive chef. So he didn't want me to cook at all. He was like, there's a lot of things you can do. Cooking ain't one of them. He said, you can go to school, do anything you want now. I just want to cook. I want to go to culinary school. And my dad was like, no, you can't do it. I went in the military. When I got out, I was going to Howard University, and I was cooking all the time. People were like, where did you? I was like, I just know how to cook. I remember my Nana finally showed me how to make her sweet potato pie. There's a small video clip on my phone, like in the kitchen, and her going, babe, you need to add a little bit more. That don't taste right. Whip it some more, baby. Baby, there's no rush. Just go ahead and just whip it some more. You know, and I'm standing there like, I have whipped it. And she's like, it don't feel right. It don't feel right. It don't feel right in my mouth. Don't open up the oven yet. I said, you told me to baste it every 5 minutes. She said, see, that's an approximation. You trying to, like, look at you. Got your phone out. You know, I had the little timer on 5 minutes. Let me run over here and base, right? She says, no, baby, that's an approximation. Like, I had to give you something to go on.
Thanks also to Claire Sullivan and Angela McKee Brown from the Edible Schoolyard Foundation, and to Callie Corey, John T. Edge, Nick Conger, and Jason Bade.
Here's a few more thank yous. The panelists you heard in this story, Jeff Moyer, Executive Director, Rodale Institute, Asmrit Asfa-Berhe, Professor of Soil Biogeochemistry, University of California, Merced, Wendy Silver, Professor of Ecosystem Ecology and Biogeochemistry, Ratan Lal, Soil Scientist, Ohio State University, and recipient of the Japan Prize for the Sustainable Soil Management for Global Food Security and Mitigation of Climate Change. Greg Brann, farmer, grazing and land management consultant. Anthony Falcavento, author and organic farmer. David Rourke, Rourke Farms Limited.
Then to get into farming, we were sitting around and my Nana was like, baby, what are we going to do with all this land? And I said, Nana, we should go back to farming it. And she said, did you say we, baby? And I said, yes, ma'am. Her, my mom, and my aunt, them sisters, got together. They reached underneath the table and gift deeded my sister and I 28 acres and was like, y'all need to get back to farming. And at the time, I was executive chef at the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C., and I'm like, I can't just leave my job. In 2011, I moved back to the farm full time. I had the conversation with my Nana about going back to school and learning about organic farming. She heard me use the word organic, and what she actually thought was chemistry. My Nana goes, baby, you sit down with me for a little while. I want to know what you learned in school. So I'm telling her what I learned. She was like, no, tell me about the organic stuff. I said, that is the organic stuff. She was like, no, baby, you talking about farming. Baby, you mean to tell me your ass went all the way to California to learn what you already know how to do? So I'm telling her about compost. And she goes, oh, you talking about the honey wagon? Like, we know how to do the honey wagon, baby. We've been making manure tea since, I don't know. I mean, your great-granddaddy used to make manure tea. And I was like, oh, my God. I could have actually just given my Nana the money and just sat at her feet. And I think we need to take the time to sit at the feet of our elders and actually listen, regardless of whether they're using a big scientific word or something as simple as the old ways. I mean, what I see here at Al Gore's Ranch, you know, the reclamation of land and how to do carbon sequestering and making sure that you rotate various animals through the pasture, spreading that manure out and letting that grass grow, putting things in paddocks, that's the old ways.
The Kitchen Sisters present as part of PRX's Radiotopia, a network of some of the most distinct, independent, and beautifully crafted podcasts. Please take care of yourself, your family, and your community, and the people who grow and cook our food. Deepest thanks to those of you who are out working, taking risks to help take care of the needs of all of us. Thanks for listening.
Radiotopia from PRX.